And one of the things that we have on here is an Army publication where the military used to have educational material teaching people, certainly teaching their officers, what the difference was between a democracy and a republic. So, for some reason, oh, here it is. So you click on it. So they go into what citizenship is, and they point out that the citizenship always leads to a dictatorship or anarchy, or something, but it does not lead to freedom. When you in a republic where you're sovereign, where you can suspend the rules on your own authority, so long as you do not impose on the sovereignty of someone else, well, that leads to freedom, because when the rules become obnoxious, you can just say, forget it, I'm not going to obey it. That's the beauty of a republic. And the founding fathers had a confidence in the public at large. They believed more in the people than they did in the specialists running government, because they knew how human nature is and how government nature is. So anyway, this is the publication by the military, very short, training manual number 2000-25, and you just click on here and we got a copy of it. It's on a it's in a word processor file. There it is. War Department, 1928. That was back when they believed in it. Yes. Okay, but anyhow, so they go into what citizenship is, and they go into all sorts of stuff, but as it relates to the military. But it's interesting, they no longer publish that manual, I understand, because basically they're trying to convert this over to a democracy. We go to the essay category on this CD, under essays. I think this is where it is. We have, here we are. In 1792, Philip Freneau wrote an article in his newspaper on how to, he wrote the rules for changing a republic into a monarchy. And of course, the intermediate step would be a democracy. So he lays out the whole plan, and if you take the time to read it, you'll see that's exactly what they've done. The one thing that's happening today that was never anticipated by the founding fathers was the arrival of the internet, electronic communications. Never in the history of the world that we know of have we ever had the high-speed communications. And I'm sure a few of you, certainly I do, have a mailing list of people you send out interesting things to, jokes or whatever, and for communicating. Well, that's the power of the press, personalized. You can duplicate your thoughts and send them out en masse for a fraction of a cent. That's pretty good. So it's an interesting, you know, knowing my history as I do, which isn't all that great, but the little bit of history I do know, I think there's an interesting race going on between the government doing its natural thing, which is taking over its own people, versus the people becoming awake and doing something about it before it happens. And I'm not sure which side's going to win, but I'll say one thing, the internet certainly upset the formula. You know, and anyhow, so there's that. Back to the foundation here. Okay, when California was admitted to the Union, it had to be a republic. So here's a copy of the admission. And they say, whereas the people of California presented a constitution and asked admission into the Union, which constitution was submitted to Congress by the President of the United States by message date February 13th, 1850, and which on due examination is found to be republican in its form of government, being enacted by, and so forth, and they went and admitted this, the state into the union. So all the states have to go through this process because the Constitution for the United States demands it, mandates it. They have to be a republican form of government before they can join. Let's talk about a court. What is a court? There's a couple of definitions. One of the definitions is legal, and the other one's practical. Okay? So, on the practical side, all a court is basically the sovereign sitting on his throne, surrounded by his courtiers, you know, the people who gravitate to the center of power. So, so the thing is that in the traditional perspective of what a king is or a dictator is, you have this story, this scenario. The king is sitting on his throne and he's looking out the window, and he sees some knave out there stealing oranges off of his favorite orange tree. So he does the kingly thing. He sends the guard out, picks the guy up, throws him in the dungeon. Okay? That's all. Very simple. After all, he's the king. Well, what happens after that is on dungeon visiting day, the knave's brother visits him. And he complains to his brother about how unfairly he was treated. He really didn't, nobody heard his side of the story, and so it's unfair that he get 3 years of prison time, dungeon time, and so forth. And of course the brother, being a brother, is very sympathetic. And he says to him, yeah, that's a bad deal. He says, I'll take care of this for you. And that night, because the brother turned out to be the chief cook, the king dies of an overdose of arsenic. That's all. That's how things got settled, you know, sometimes. Well, that's a bad deal for kings. So we got this court system. Now just, let's recast the scenario. King's sitting on his throne, he looks out the window, and he sees some knave stealing oranges off his favorite orange tree. So far the story is the same. So he sends the guard out. The guard goes out, picks up the guy, brings him before. They accuse him of doing this. They ask him how he pleads. They get the various witnesses. They set up the procedure. They make an announcement, a public announcement. We're going to have this trial on a certain date. Everybody shows up at the trial, including the knave's brother, the chief cook. And they have the trial, they present the evidence, and then they have a decision. If necessary, maybe have a jury out there, you know, to look at it and so forth. Then they convict him, and then he gets his 3 years in the dungeon. Okay? Now, on dungeon visiting day, the brother visits the prisoner, and the prisoner complains about what an unfair deal it was, how he didn't really do it, and so on. And the brother says, look, bro, he says, I attended your trial. I saw the evidence. I said, you know, I'm sorry, but you kind of earned it. And so, as a consequence of that, the king gets to live another day, arsenic-free day. Okay? So what I'm pointing out here is that the number one purpose of a court, above all the other things that you've heard, all the things you've read about, all the court rules and procedures and everything else, the number one thing about a court is that it is a stage upon which the sovereign puts a show to convince the rest of the world that the sovereign is right. That's the purpose of a court. Okay? Nothing can violate that rule. I don't care what what goes on in the courtroom and so forth, that is the number one rule you never violate. You must put on a good show, okay, or stamp a seal on it. And so the clerk stamped a seal on it. It was a rubber stamp, and it had four letters, S-E-A-L. Seal. That was their seal. That's the United States District Court. Okay? So that's all it takes for a seal. And so a seal's not exactly a big deal as far as its form, what its form is. However, a seal is an important item. A contract between two parties is always a quid pro quo situation. In other words, you get something for something. You give up something, but you get something in return. That's what all contracts are. Those are called bilateral contracts because they work both directions. A unilateral contract is not enforceable, okay? If somebody says to you, I'm going to give you $1,000 on Sunday, you don't have to do anything about it, I'm just going to give it to you. And you make plans on that $1,000, and when Sunday comes, he says, I changed my mind. You have no case, okay? Because there was nothing required of you. You didn't have to give up anything to get it. So a unilateral contract is simply not enforceable in any court, okay? Now, having said that, there's one exception to that rule, and that's if the promise is sealed. If the person says, I'll give you $1,000 next Sunday, puts it in writing and seals it, the seal is the consideration, and when that seal goes on it, it's real, and that is enforceable. So now they're trying to minimize the importance of the seal, and you'll see that a writing that is signed is considered as good as a writing that's sealed. Words to that effect, I don't remember the exact words that are in the statutes, but the thing that I notice is that all of government, all the courts, they all have seals. So I don't believe what I read. And it's a common law. They're not going to be able to change the common law. The seal is there to stay. Okay? Now, going beyond that, if you look in Black's Law Dictionary, you look up what a court of record is, you'll see in Black's Law Dictionary, the 5th edition, that a court of record has the power to fine or imprison for contempt, and that it keeps a record of the proceedings. Okay? So that's what Black's 5th edition says. It leaves out the other two requirements. If you look in Black's Law Dictionary, 4th edition and earlier, you'll find all four requirements there. Interesting. Yeah. The fourth requirement is that it's proceeding according to the common law. That means no statutes, no codes. Okay? The highest court of the land is a court of record. Okay? No statutes, no codes. So, you're proceeding according to the common law. Anybody ever hear of statute of limitations? Mm-hmm. Doesn't apply in a court of record. Mm-hmm. Why?
Statutes don't apply.
There's no statutes in the common law. If a court of record's proceeding according to the common law, then statutes don't mean anything.
So they make the bed, they better sleep on it.
Yep. Yes, sir.
Is there such a thing as an Article 3 court?
Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah, but that's under the Constitution. We're outside the Constitution in the common law. We're in an Article 0 court. Okay? My own sovereign court.
So, I guess the first thing is you have to establish that you are proceeding under common law as opposed to statutory law.
Correct. Correct. And I'll show you how to do that. It's real easy. In fact, it's fun. When you see how we do this, you're going to love it. But we'll get to that. But anyway, ultimately, you challenge them because by what can we say that one human being has anything over another human being? Well, the response, the inquisitional response, would be, well, God sent me to tell you. Now, how can you argue against God? Okay? I mean, that's the ultimate argument, at least back then. Well, if you look at verse 22, it turns out that we're equal to God. That means, if we're truly equal, now we're not equal in terms of creating life or creating universes and, you know, a lot of areas, but we are equal when it comes to knowing good and evil. That's the point. And so you just simply say back to the person, well, thank you very much for bringing the message from God. I will take it under advisement. Okay? And you consider it, and if I get a message from God, I'm going to respectfully consider it. But I still have free will, independence, and equality to make a decision as to whether it's truly good or evil, whatever the issue is. And I don't know, might decide the pink shoes are okay if I were the accused, you see? So that's the beauty of that. Now, this is backed up by 1 Timothy, where the full name is Paul's first epistle to Timothy. And Paul wrote a letter to Timothy explaining a few things. And one of the things that he explained was that he says right in there, the law is for the lawless. Okay? It's not for the virtuous. There's three criteria that he names in there. You have to be faith unfeigned. You have to be, basically, you have to have a good intent. And the law is not written for the person with good intent. The law is written for the person who is the lawbreaker. Now, what we're talking about here is, you see, when Eve ate the fruit of the garden along with Adam, that was, according to that story, that is when we achieved the knowledge of good and evil. And that's sometimes called the law of the heart. In other words, you know, you're born with this knowledge. Nobody has to teach it to you. You know certain things. And so, if you violate that law, then we have the written law to tell you what to do. Well, as it turned out, there were a lot of people, apparently, who ignored the law of the heart. And so, at some point in time, out came this thing called the Ten Commandments. And we told people what to do. You can't do this, you can't do that. Well, that law was not for the lawful person. That law, the Ten Commandments, was for the person who ignored his deal. And this reflects in our system of jurisprudence, because you know, for example, to pick a very obvious example, you know that one of the Ten Commandments is thou shalt not kill. Now you're driving down the street, you're doing 25 miles an hour in a 35 mile an hour zone, and a little kid runs out from between some parked cars and you can't stop and you kill him. Did you violate the commandment that says thou shalt not kill? No, in our system of thought, our philosophy, you are not held responsible. Why? Because you did not have the intent. Okay? If you have not the intent, then there is no conviction. You are not persecuted for accidents. Now that's different from what goes on in Islam. And I read about a case where this guy, an American, that might have had something to do with it, I don't know, but he parked in a parking lot. Okay? And his car was the only car there. And he went into the building. While he was in the building, a hot rodder came around, happened to be a native, okay? And he went too fast to get around that curve. And instead of navigating the curve, he went off into the parking lot, hit the American's car, and I don't know if it killed him or not, but certainly it created major damage, okay? So it got into court, Islamic court. And the American was held responsible. And the judge explained it to him, that what had happened was that the American had made a choice. He could have parked somewhere else. But because he made the choice that he did, he was being held responsible for his choice. A little different way of looking, okay? So in our Judeo-Christian concepts, we do not hold you responsible for genuine accidents. We do hold you responsible when you intentionally do something. Or even if not intentional, if you are irresponsible. You know, if you're doing 100 miles an hour in a 25 mile an hour zone on a crowded street, that's probably considered irresponsible, you see. And that's why we have juries to draw that dividing line of responsibility. Anyway, so those are...
That was the Hammurabi Code, which is eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth.
Oh, Hammurabi Code, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Okay. Well, yeah.
Islam.
Sure. Well, anyway, so that's my 2 cents worth on the religious or the biblical connection to our system. And I have been told that behind the scenes that these are effective rules. I don't know. I never speak about them in my actual papers.
Can you elaborate more on that international law? Oh,
yeah. Well, international law doesn't really exist. It's actually, they left a word out. It should be international common law. Because the international law operates just like the common law that we're familiar with. It's basically, you got to get together and have a contract to agree among yourselves and who's responsible for what. And they don't have a jury, but they assign a judge. But the judge, as things exist right now, has no more power than the participants agree to let them have power. The accused may decide not to go to the international court. So what do they do? Nothing, right? I mean, I think that's the status of things these days. So international court only works if the parties will contract to it. And that's basically how common law works, excepting that in the common law, if you have an injury, you can force the other person into the court. Why? Because we have a third party power to enforce it, somebody with the guns that'll come in and back us up. That's called the marshal or the sheriff, okay? We don't have that on the international level yet. At least not, it's not operating perfectly.
Well, the only thing that you're firing is
microphone.
War.
Yeah. Okay. So now, anyway, it's proceeding according to the common law and not statutes. That's what a court of record is. The fifth one is the killer requirement. This is the one that I just love. The tribunal is independent of the magistrate. Okay? Now, the tribunal is the one that does the judging. The magistrate is the one who's up there. He's not creating court orders, but he's enforcing them. The magistrate is an administrator. He has no power of discretion. He cannot, quote, judge anything, okay, unless you give him permission to. So the tribunal is independent of the magistrate. The one who does the judging is independent of the guy who's conducting the proceedings. Now, what is a magistrate? Since we know that the tribunal is independent, what is a magistrate? Well, we look down here. Magistrate. An official entrusted with the administration of the laws, okay? Not the management, not the creation, just administration. No thinking allowed on the part of the judge. That's what administrators do. They follow the rules. They don't make up the rules, okay? And as the sovereign of the court, you're the rule maker, and if you wish to suspend a rule, you can, okay? So, a magistrate is a person clothed with power as a public civil officer. That's a magistrate. And we're saying here that in a court of record, the tribunal is independent of a magistrate. The tribunal is independent of a public civil officer. Okay? The judge is a public civil officer. He's a magistrate. How do I know that? Well, obviously I've concluded it from these descriptions, but you don't really have to be smart enough to conclude it. All you have to do is go down to California Penal Code, Section 808, persons designated as magistrates. The following persons are magistrates: the judge of the Supreme Court, the judges of the courts of appeal, the judges of the superior courts, the judges of the municipal courts, and the judges of the justice courts. They're all magistrates.
All of them
are magistrates. Okay? Are you satisfied that judges are magistrates? Well, now, the tribunal is the one who does the judging. And he's independent of the magistrates. Right here. Number five.
So when you separate the tribunal and the magistrate, which one comes first, the denominator or the numerator? When you put a slice in
It's not who comes first, it's what the job description is. Okay?
The tribunal comes first.
The magistrate administers, the tribunal decides.
Right.
Okay? So when you are the sovereign of the court, I mean, you have your kingdom. Now, if you want to grant power to the judge to make a decision for you, you can. And that's what happens. You go to court, and right away, what do? They bring in statutes, codes, right? I mean, you have your attorney write up the papers. He says code such and such, blah, 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 right? Well, right there, you're not in a court of record for that reason alone, because he brought in the statutes. All right? And then you go to court and the judge makes a decision. Boom, right there you know you're not in a court of record if the judge is making a decision. Of course, if you're in a court of record, and if you understand that, and if you're watching out for your rights, when he makes a decision, what do?
Object,
right. You say, I object. Why do you object? Now remember, you're the plaintiff when you do all this. This doesn't work if you're the defendant. Very important. Notice that. This only works if you're a plaintiff. All this stuff I'm telling you is only the prerogative of the plaintiff, the sovereign plaintiff. It is never the prerogative of the defendant. This does not work if you're a defendant. You do not own the court if you're a defendant. You're a subject of the court. So you must be the plaintiff if you're going to do any of this stuff. That's not such a tough thing to be. Because if you are the defendant, they started the trouble, I assume. Okay, they're coming after you. So you do a counterclaim, now you become the plaintiff, they become the defendant, and the issue that you raise is their jurisdiction. Do they have jurisdiction or not? And everything must stop until they prove their jurisdiction. No jurisdiction, what business do they have of proceeding? And how do we know they have jurisdiction until they prove it? Okay, so that doesn't mean they do stop. I mean, you have to sometimes really get tough with these people. But they'll try to proceed anyway because they're always testing your knowledge. Right? They don't give up easily.
Oh, they don't?
No, they don't. If anybody knows it, she does. So, yeah, they don't give up easily. But you have to know to object. You've got to make the record. By the way, does anybody here know what the record is? What is a record? That's all right. That's all right. You don't have to answer it. I'll tell you. Okay? There's a lot of confusion about a record. The docket sheet that you see when you go down to the court is not the record. The docket sheet contains in it the record, but the whole docket sheet is not the record. What the record is a chronology of only two things: what was proposed to the court and what the decision was that was made. That's it. That is the record. All the other detailed transcripts, whatever it is, that is not the record.
What's the second one?
The decision made. The first thing is what was proposed to the court, like a motion, for example. And the second thing is what was the decision made. That is the record and nothing else.
They're in the back now.
The other stuff is supplemental, supportive, but the record is, what are you asking of the court? And did the court grant it or not? That's it. Okay? So, when the court keeps a record of the proceedings, that's all it's doing. Now, I'm sure everyone here is familiar with the word patient. You know, a doctor's patient. Now, does an auto mechanic have patients? No. He has customers, right? Does a lawyer have patients? No. He has clients. Okay? Only a doctor has patients. The doctors own the word patient. Okay? That is specifically associated with their profession. The word client is in this, just like the word patient is owned by doctors, the word client is owned by attorneys. A client is somebody with whom you have an attorney-client relationship, okay? And you can make decisions for him. Okay, you have control of his life. Power of attorney, that's exactly right. And so a licensed attorney has a higher level of attorney relationship than a normal power of attorney would have. Okay, because he can actually follow through in court, in the existing courts. So the attorneys own the word client. It is not proper to say, for example, an accountant does not have clients. They say it all the time. But that's an abuse of the word. The original proper legal meaning of the word client is as it's used in relation to an attorney. Now the word record is owned by a court of record. Equity courts do not keep records. Even though everything looks the same, they are not properly called records. Okay? That's why they call them docket sheets. Okay? They're called docket sheets. They're dockets. Because they're not records. Or what do they call it? There's another name I've been coming across now.
Transcript.
Not transcript, but I think it's something about actions. I forget anyway, but anyway, they have actions, listings of actions, okay? And because they're not records. Only a court of record keeps records. The word record is properly only used when talking about the decisions and proposals that are made in a court of record. That's it. That's what a real record is.
Equity courts do not keep records?
That's correct. Okay. They may keep notes. They have a list of actions that were taken, but those are not properly called records. Now, all right, so the court of record is the one court. Now, if you look at the Constitution, let's go back to the Constitution, specifically Article 3.
I know.
Wrong tie. And the thing that I want you to notice is that when you're up close anyway, the stripes go this way.
Yes.
The stripes do not go the other way. Okay, that's not an accident.
Right to left.
I select this tie based on the stripes. You want to do a close-up? Okay.
And you're telling me you're the passenger, not the driver.
I should have perhaps worn a more obvious tie, but anyway, the stripes go like you're reaching for your sword. The sword was worn on the left side, and you reach across, you pull it out, you're ready to do battle. Okay? So the sovereigns, when you look at the no parking signs, you know you have the circle with the stripe? The stripe goes the same way. That's an order from the sovereign. Okay? That stripe is a sovereign. Now, if you go the other way, that would be from a subject. Okay? So that
from right to the left?
Yeah, from the upper right shoulder to the lower left hip.
Yeah,
And you'll see when they when at public affairs and they these metal happy public officials and they have these wide strips going across. That's the way they go across this way because they're representing the sovereign authority.
Those sashes?
Yeah, the sashes, but they go the other way, not the way you indicated.
Right.
And so that if you go to court and you put on a suit and tie, please make sure the stripes go the right way. If the stripes go the right way, it's pretty meaningless. But if the stripes go the wrong way, number one, and number two, if the judge is educated, he'll know you're ignorant. Okay? If you have the stripes go the right way, he doesn't know. He has no way of knowing if you're ignorant or not. He has to use other criteria. If he knows what he's doing and he's in tune with those concepts and you have a tie going the wrong way, he knows you don't know what you're talking about. You're not really sovereign. Heraldry is that the stripes going that way represent the sovereignty. Okay? Now, when if you pay attention to these details and you're aware of it, you can see this in operation. Now, here's an interesting thing. When the United States was founded, let me just say this. In England, the stripes go the other way. Everybody who wears a tie in England, the stripes go the other way. Now, about 40 years ago, I noticed something. I noticed that here in the United States, they started introducing neutral ties. Okay? In over a 10-year period, I saw the number of striped ties that went this way kind of go down a bit and more neutral ties were available. For about a 10-year period after that, the second 10 years, I noticed they introduced ties with stripes going the other way in the American market. And then in the third 10 years, I noticed that you had to hunt all over place to find a tie with a stripe that went this way. What are they doing? They're Europeanizing the United States. They're trying to convert our system over to their system. You see, when we broke away from England, we said everybody is a sovereign. So everybody wore a tie with the stripes going this way. There are people who understood these things. Okay, these were the outward signs. And I know it seems frivolous, okay?
No.
I mean, it does, in a way it is frivolous. I mean, what difference does a stripe make, you know, in terms of who and what you are? But remember, people look at you and judge you. And if you understand these subtleties, then you have a better chance of getting what you want out of the system. Because even though you cannot tell them how smart you are, you can avoid telling them how dumb you are. Okay? So don't wear a tie with a stripe going the other way. Not when you go to court. All right? You never know who's up on that bench.
Probably a Freemason anyways.
Okay? Don't believe anything I tell you. You verify it. If somebody gives you a case, how many times, I don't know how deep you do your research, but how many times has somebody given you a case that was absolutely said exactly what you needed, and you went and you looked it up and you couldn't even find the words in the case?
Yeah.
All right? Check everything. I don't care how reliable the person seems to you. Check everything. Do not accept anything from anybody without checking it, and that includes me. I want to talk about the officers of the court. The officers of court, that's nothing special. All that is people who have jobs. Okay? They have different functions. So I can represent some of those functions. Like, for example, I think I got one here. Who do you think this represents? The court clerk. A surfer. when the clerk takes the day off, he goes surfing. So you see, the court clerk, he has his own hat, right? And you recognize it right away. Somebody said it before I said it. Okay? So that's one of the jobs. Let's see, what other jobs do we have here? Here we go. Here's a nice one. No, that's the attorney. Right? So he wears that hat. Okay? Now.
No powdered wig? We got to get another prop for you, Bill.
Court jester.
That's right, the court jester. See, you know your court structure. All right? I mean, you have to take time out. You remember right at the beginning, I said sometimes you have to have a little sense of humor and levity, okay? Court can be fun sometimes. And, of course, they acknowledge that in court, they acknowledge that they have to take a break once in a while because that's a long-standing tradition to have a jester in the court. That's his job.
Have you ever worn that hat in court?
No, but I probably ought to sometimes. Okay? Well, let's see. What else have we got here?
I want to see the powdered wig.
Of course you do.
Hey, you got it.
Of course.
You're wearing that, you must be an eagle.
Okay. There you are. Okay. So the magistrate. Now, have any of you ever wondered why the wigs are always white? You ever wondered?
They run out of black.
No, they're always white.
Why
is there a tradition of white wigs? There was a period in time when the nobility had a lot of power struggles. Of course, there's always power struggles. I mean, that's guaranteed. But the power struggles got a little serious, and the customary way of settling power struggles was to incorporate arsenic. You know, you incorporate arsenic.
Poison.
Put a little arsenic in the food.
Poison.
What?
That usually settled up an argument about power, okay? Whoever ate it first lost. So arsenic was very common, right? And that is how they settled. And it was brother against sister, father against son. I mean, there was no loyalty. You read the history. I've got a little book. I should have brought it in, I guess. But I have a little book on the history of Europe. And it's just a little book with maybe 100 pages. But every single page has at least 3 or 4 descriptions of somebody killing somebody in order to get in charge. Okay? I mean, this is how they did it. No loyalty among each other. They had nothing to do. They didn't work. You know, they would kill each other in order. Well, and arsenic was the favorite method. Well, somebody discovered that if you eat a little bit of arsenic each day, you could build up your immunity and you could take quite a hit with no effect. But the side effect was that your hair turned white. So all the nobility had white hair. And so it was very easy to tell the nobility, a nobleman, from a commoner. Commoner had colored hair. Nobility had white hair. Of course, that was why they ate arsenic. Okay? Well, when arsenic lost its favoritism and no longer became popular, the tradition continued. And so when you have high court proceedings or very formal proceedings, they put on the white wigs. And that's why, because of the nobility. Oh, yeah. Well, they're you know, I mean, look at the glorification of police now. When one of them dies, it's like a religious event, you know? And people seem to gravitate to that sort of thing. They like glorifying. Let's see. All right. Superior court versus inferior court. You're going to love this. A superior court is a court of record. An inferior court is a court that's not a court of record. Okay?
Superior court is a court of record.
Right. Or the other way around. A court of record is a superior court. That's spelled with a small s. Now, Just to keep you confused, at least here in California, they name the courts Superior Court, but that's just the name. Okay? Don't confuse the name with the function. So the Superior Court, capitalized, usually is an inferior court. How do you know? It's not a court of record. It's not proceeding according to the common law. The judge is making a decision. The tribunal is not independent of the magistrate. Those are the two big ones right there. Okay? So anytime you walk into a courtroom, you see that judge making a decision. I don't care if they call it the Superior Court. It's an inferior court.
Or you have to,
that's what I would do.
You have to object to the proceedings?
Sure.
Counterclaim?
Yeah, if you carry it out to the full formal extent, you would counterclaim them, but in a superior court, a real superior court. Okay? Now,
would that be an Article 3 court?
No, Article 3 court is a court that's under the Constitution of the United States. That Article 3 refers to the Article 3 of the United States Constitution. No, this is a court of record. Take it for what it is on its surface, on its face. Okay? Don't try to make more out of it than what it is. So, a court of record has its criteria. I gave you the criteria, and that's backed up by case law. I mean, there's been cases on that where that was challenged, and the court said, no, this is what a court of record is. So, but let's look at superior court versus inferior court. Okay. Now, in Ex parte Kearney, 55 Cal 212, and in Smith versus Andrews in 6 Cal 652, the court said, inferior courts are those whose jurisdiction is limited and special and whose proceedings are not according to the course of the common law. Pretty clear to me. I don't know. What do you think? Okay? Their jurisdiction is limited. Let me show you an example of what we mean by limited. Can a criminal court judge a civil matter?
No.
No. Can a civil court judge a criminal matter?
No.
Okay, these are limited jurisdiction courts, so therefore they're inferior courts. When you go to court and you try to make an argument, and the judge shuts you down because he says that's not related, okay, what is he doing? He's saying we're staying within the limitations of this court. See, like the guy, we've all heard about the case, I'm sure, where the burglar came in through the roof and he fell.
Yeah.
And he got trapped in the garage, and therefore he sued and won for damages because he couldn't get out of the garage. Okay? Now, when you take the whole big picture, when you take the whole big picture into account, that doesn't make sense. Now, I didn't see this case, but I can imagine how it went. You know, the burglar is suing the homeowner. The homeowner is saying, but you broke in. And the judge is saying, that has nothing to do with the case. You cannot trap a person in a container. Well, I'm just saying that the court had limited jurisdiction. The judge could not listen to anything else. He could only listen to the immediate things relating to this. Was he trapped or not trapped? Okay? Doesn't matter how he got there. Okay. Now, a court that has unlimited jurisdiction, which is a superior court, it can take these factors into account. Okay? It can take everything into account. It can take into whether the sun was up or down into account. Okay?
Interesting.
So, that's the big... one of the big differences between a superior court and an inferior court. Now, criminal courts proceed according to statutory law. Jurisdiction and procedure is defined by statute. Likewise, civil courts and admiralty courts proceed according to statutory law. Any court proceeding according to statutory law is not a court of record. Court of record only proceeds according to common law. It is an inferior court. Now, the only inherent difference ordinarily recognized between superior and inferior courts is that there is a presumption in favor of the validity of the judgments of the superior court and no presumption in favor of the validity of the inferior court. Okay? Superior court makes a decision, we presume, unless there's some extraordinary reason otherwise, we presume it's a correct decision. If it's an inferior court, we don't make that presumption. We don't presume it's bad either. It just doesn't carry any automatic validity with it. Why? Because it didn't take all the factors into account. It only operated within its limited perception, its limited scope. Okay? Going on, it says, a superior court may be shown not to have had power to render a particular judgment by reference to its record. So you look at the record, and you can see whether or not it had jurisdiction. Okay? If it had no jurisdiction, then its judgment is no good. But if it had jurisdiction, it has a good judgment. Okay? Note that in California, superior court is the name of a particular court. Okay? So when it's capitalized. When a court acts by virtue of a special statute conferring jurisdiction in a certain class of cases, what are we talking about? We're talking about criminal courts, civil courts, right? Those are classes of cases. Okay. When a court acts by virtue of a special statute conferring jurisdiction in a certain class of cases, it is a court of inferior or limited jurisdiction for the time being, no matter what its ordinary status may be. Okay? The decisions of a superior court can only be challenged in a court of appeal. Okay, but the decisions of an inferior court are subject to collateral attack. In other words, in a superior court, one may sue an inferior court directly rather than resort to appeal to an appellate court. So you go through a case, they wouldn't let you put all the evidence in because it wasn't relevant, according to the judge. So after it's all over and the smoke blows away, you now file a suit and you name the court as a defendant. But you're not suing for money, you're suing for decision. Okay? The original defendants, they are the ones at risk. The original plaintiff who came against you, he's the one that's at risk for money. But you sue that court because your claim is the court was an inferior court, therefore couldn't make a good decision, didn't make a good decision. And we have to get all the facts in, all of the considerations, and that's why we're reopening the case in a real superior court.
So we're not in a court of record.
You're in a court of record the second time.
The second time.
Yeah. Second time you open it up in a court of record. You open up. Remember, a court of record is a superior court. Also, a superior court is a court of record. Works both directions. Okay? You're proceeding according to the common law. The tribunal is independent of the magistrate. So any case you have, you can reopen.
No statute of limitations.
No statute of limitations, because there's no statutes in common law.
Is this different than a counterclaim?
No. A counterclaim is when somebody makes a claim against you. Well, a cross-complaint, that doesn't count either.
Okay.
But a counterclaim is when somebody has a claim against you, and then you come back and make a claim against them. But in order to make your counterclaim really stick as a counterclaim, the first thing you have to do is challenge their jurisdiction. If they do not have jurisdiction, then all of the consequential injuries that you suffered now become collectible items. Okay? Mm-hmm. So, So the decisions of a superior court may only be challenged in a court of appeal. But that little statement only applies to state courts. It does not apply to your court of record. Okay? Let's see. Let's go.
Can you repeat that sentence again? I didn't quite catch it. The last sentence.
Well, now I'm in trouble.
No, it applies to them, but
it applies the ability to appeal a decision only applies to state courts. It does not apply to your private court. Okay? Your court of record, where you're the sovereign of the court, well, it's King's Bench, basically. In other words, you're the king. You're there. So there is no appeal from the king. All right? So there is appeal from a state court because the king's not there. The judge is sitting there. If they're operating according to the common law, I'm not sure how they ever worked that out. But I've never seen a court of record, frankly. They're all equity courts. In the English language, if the gender is unknown, then we use the masculine gender.
That's okay. I'm
that's
fine.
A rule. So when somebody uses the masculine gender, you do not know if the gender is male or female. See? A lot of people object to it because they don't understand the neutrality of that. So anyhow, now you're going to love this next item. Okay. This last paragraph, I really ought to put this up front. Maybe I'll get around and revise this thing, the website. But it's the last paragraph. But listen to this. The Supreme Court in Schneckloth versus Bustamante, 412 U.S. 218, on page 255 in 1973, that case in 1973 cited a very old case called Ex Parte Watkins, 3 Peters at 202 and 203. And what they said was this, here it is. No statutory or constitutional court, whether it be an appellate or Supreme Court, can second guess the judgment of a court of record. Quote, the judgment of a court of record whose jurisdiction is final is as conclusive on all the world as the judgment of this court would be, this court being the Supreme Court. It is as conclusive on this court as it is on other courts. It puts an end to inquiry concerning the fact by deciding it. So when you have a court of record and you come to that final judgment, that's it, kiddo. Not appealable. Now, that doesn't mean you can't go at it again. Remember I said earlier that you can have a new trial on a case. But what's the probability of winning? You know? However the jury decided last time, it's going to decide the same thing this time.
You know, so it could be a different jury.
Different jury. I mean, if you really had a jury that went awry, yeah, it might be worth a shot. But again, third trial only happens 2-3 times in a century. You know, it doesn't happen often at all. And so the system works, you know. But it's a new jury considering new things. There have to be new things pretty much, unless, like I said, you got a really sick jury, which is not likely. Anyway, the court of record, the decision of the court of record is not appealable. Any decision comes out of your court of record is not appealable. Your court is King's Bench. By the way, the word bench means court. Okay, so it's King's Bench. You, whatever the king decides, you can't go above the sovereign. Okay, so whoever you're suing, if they don't ask for a jury of sovereigns, of peers, well then, ain't gonna make it. You know? You had a question.
Yeah, Bill. California Constitution says that a court of record. All three levels of courts, Superior Court, Appellate Court, and Supreme Court, are courts of record.
Right.
So why did they do that if a court of record is not appealable.
Well, state courts, well, that is an anomaly. But remember this. The superior court can be an inferior court. We need a microphone here. The superior court may be an inferior court, and its decisions are appealable to the appellate court, which is a court of record, which can take everything into account. On the other hand, if the appellate court acts like an inferior court, its decision can be appealed to the court of record called the superior court. Let's see. Now, you all know, I'm going to bring out some important things in the review here. Number one, what are the two significant points about sovereignty that I've repeated before?
What's the question?
What are the two significant things about sovereignty? What is characteristic of a sovereign?
No accountability to a higher level.
Right, that's one.
The
decree of the sovereign makes law. Right. Very important. When you sue somebody, you make your decree of what the law is that you're saying got violated. The laws that you're claiming that they broke. They have an obligation to you of some kind. It could be an obligation to pay you money, or it could be an obligation to not punch you in the nose. But whatever the obligation is, an obligation to do or an obligation to not do, whatever that obligation is, you decree what the law is. So that's one point, that you have a court of record, or not a court of record, I meant to say sovereignty has these two features. There's other features too, but those are the key ones. Okay, no accountability to higher authority. And the decree of the sovereign makes law. Sovereignty is an important aspect of what we do here. You've got to have your sovereignty. Now, in order to make it work, you've got to be the plaintiff. So I assume that you all know how to do a lawsuit. Now, This session we're having today is not a session on procedure. This is a session on concepts. I'm giving you the concepts with which to do procedure. We talk a little bit about procedure, but the emphasis is on concepts. Now, there is a company called a website called jurisdictionary.com. J-U-R-I-S, as in Sam, dictionary, all one word, jurisdictionary.com. And they sell a course, I think it's for $219, a two-day course, and it's written by an attorney. It all has to do with procedure. Yeah, he goes into procedures, he talks about motions, he talks about evidence, talks about all kinds of stuff. Basically, he gives it a round of picture. He says it's a two-day course. I suspect it takes longer to study it. But nevertheless, he's gone to the trouble to give you the generally acceptable court procedures that apply to all courts. So if you take that procedure-wise and add to it the concepts that we have here, you've got a real powerful combination. I haven't focused on procedure because he has. No point in reinventing the wheel.
Yeah.
And it's very reasonably priced. I want you to lock down in your mind those two things about sovereignty. This is extremely important that you always keep this in mind. That you're not accountable to higher authority, and your decree makes law. Also, I want you to remember what a republic is. You're in your sovereign capacity. Now, if you're sovereign, you do what sovereigns do. You have your own court system. You have your own laws. You can do all that stuff. The thing that keeps you from getting too extravagant is the fact that if you do decide to enforce your laws against someone, They can always call a jury who can sit in judgment of your laws. You don't remember that. What is the number one definition of a court?
Stage.
It's a stage upon which you put a show. So if you're going to go in and buck the traditions and buck the customary way of doing things, all that does is generate trouble for you. Because, you know, there was this gentleman in Germany. His name was Goethe, I think it was. He was a philosopher. And he said that there's nothing so fearful as ignorance in action. Okay?
Fearful as what?
As ignorance in action. There is nothing so fearful as ignorance in action.
Okay.
And so you go in there with your superior knowledge, supposedly superior, and these people don't know what you do, and they just might go into action. And you might find yourself behind bars, all because you knew something they didn't. And you knew that it didn't matter whether or not you wore a hat. But they told you to take the hat off, and you didn't, so you went to jail. Okay?
Well, that's the only thing.
I suggest that you don't challenge the people around you. Remember this. There's a very important rule. In the land of the insane, the sane man will be adjudged insane.
Yeah.
Okay?
That's true.
So, understand who's around you, and you know, you've got to put a proper show on, and you got to take into account that you're not actually free, even though you think you are, because you can get these kickbacks, or blowbacks, I think is the new term.
What?
Well, basically, you had to put up with either their lack of knowledge or their choice to ignore what they knew.
Oh, yeah, they did.
That happens. Well, anyhow, so keep in mind, as I said before, what sovereignty is. Keep in mind that the number one rule about courts is that it's a show. You want to put on a good show. And even though you're right, if it's a bad show, then don't do it. Don't claim it unless it's really, really critical to what you're doing. Keep in mind what a court of record is. And that is proceeding according to the common law, and don't allow the judge to make any decisions. Okay? Now, if you're the sovereign of the court, you're the plaintiff, if the judge makes a decision, all you do is you object. We have on this disc, what do you do when you are in front of a judge? Okay? This is very important. See, when you have your paper, when you're in your court process and you've done your counterclaim, if you're in front of a judge, the reason you're there is because somebody, either you or the other side, is asking the court to do something. That's called a motion. Okay? And so the judge is going to try and make a decision. If it's your court and you have a court of record, he cannot make a decision. He's prohibited. But that doesn't mean he won't do it. And so you, when you're in front of that judge, you want to be able to keep things under control. And under control in the sense that even if he doesn't do the right thing, you're not lost. Okay? So you have to be the plaintiff, as I said before. Now here's what happens. I'll just read off this article. It's short and sweet. When you are a plaintiff and one of the people of the United States or a state in a court of record, the judge has no power to make a decision unless you grant it to him. The tribunal, which is either you or a jury, is independent of the magistrate, and all judges in California are magistrates. When in court, there is no need to argue your case. All of your arguments should have been made in the preceding paperwork. The only reason for a court hearing is to give the court an opportunity to ask questions of the litigants to clarify any points. Anything you say in court is considered a novation to your papers on file. Your verbal actions override your previous papers. That's why you don't talk in court. Now, get this. Somebody makes a motion. That's whatever it is that he wants. Says, I want this from the court. The other person answers the motion from his side. And he introduces his own pecados, whatever. And then you have a third chance to come back and say whatever it is, but your answer, your reply to his answer is narrowed down to the issues that were raised in his paper, okay? That's your typical three-paper set. Everything you have to say should be in those papers. Basically, you spoke on paper and the other side spoke on paper. That's your speaking. The only reason for a court hearing is so that the court can ask you questions. That's it. A court doesn't have to have a hearing at all. And in fact, if you go down to Florida, down there in those courts, you put your motions in and you get your rulings back. You never have